Welcome, fellow internetizen. I never took out citizenship, did you? Internetian, to the 43rd consecutive week of Spider on the Web. This pod is not actually cast. To save money, we have it spot welded. The die was cast, and that's why we need to save the money. Like all 42 previous pod welds, this one is brought to you under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial. Without nearer ado, here, as promised, is some more fun from Cory Doctorow's lively new novel, Little Brother. You'll recall Chapter 1 ran here a few weeks ago. Here's the second excerpt Cory sent along with it, Chapter 12. Behold the glory of Cory from Alpha Centauri and his non-gory, non-hoary story. The Doctorow is in.
Mission burritos are an institution. They are cheap, giant, and delicious. Imagine a tube the size of a bazooka shell, filled with spicy grilled meat, guacamole, salsa, tomatoes, refried beans, rice, onions, and cilantro. It has the same relationship to Taco Bell that a Lamborghini has to a Hot Wheels car. There are about 200 Mission burrito joints. They're all heroically ugly, with uncomfortable seats, minimal decor, faded Mexican tourist office posters, and electrified framed Jesus and Mary holograms, and loud mariachi music. The thing that distinguishes them mostly is what kind of exotic meat they fill their wares with. The really authentic places have brains and tongue, which I never order, but it's nice to know it's there. The place we went to had both brains and tongue, which we didn't order. I got carne asada, and she got shredded chicken, and we each got a big cup of horchata. As soon as we sat down, she unrolled her burrito and took a little bottle out of her purse. It was a little stainless steel aerosol canister that looked for all the world like a pepper spray self-defense unit. She aimed it at a burrito's exposed guts and misted them with a fine red oily spray. I caught a whiff of it and my throat closed and my eyes watered. What the hell are you doing to that poor defenseless burrito? She gave me a wicked smile. I'm a spicy food addict, she said. This is capsaicin oil in a mister. Capsaicin? Yeah, the stuff in pepper spray. This is like pepper spray, but slightly more dilute, and way more delicious. Think of it as spicy Cajun Visine, if it helps. My eyes burned just thinking of it. You're kidding, I said. You are so not going to eat that. Her eyebrows shot up. That sounds like a challenge, Sonny. You just watch me. She rolled the burrito up as carefully as a stoner rolling up a joint, tucking the ends in, then rewrapping it in the tinfoil. She peeled off one end and brought it up to her mouth, poised with it just before her lips. Right up to the time she bit into it, I couldn't believe that she was going to do it. I mean, that was basically an anti-personnel weapon she'd just slathered on her dinner. She bit into it, chewed, swallowed, gave every impression of having a delicious dinner. Want a bite? She said innocently. Yeah, I said. I like spicy food. I always order the curries with four chilies next to them on the menu at the Pakistani places. I peeled back more foil and took a big bite. Big mistake. You know that feeling you get when you take a big bite of horseradish or wasabi or whatever, and it feels like your sinuses are closing at the same time as your windpipe, filling your head with trapped nuclear hot air that tries to batter its way out through your watering eyes and nostrils? That feeling like steam is about to pour out of your ears like a cartoon character? This was a lot worse. This was like putting your hand on a hot stove, only it's not your hand, it's the entire inside of your head and your esophagus all the way down to your stomach. My entire body sprang out in a sweat, and I choked and choked. Wordlessly, she passed me my horchata, and I managed to get the straw into my mouth and suck hard on it, gulping down half of it in one go. So there's a scale, the Scoville scale, that we chili fanciers used to talk about how spicy a pepper is. Pure capsaicin is about 15 million Scovilles. Tabasco is about 2,500. Pepper spray is a healthy 3 million. This stuff is a puny 100,000, about as hot as a mild Scotch bonnet pepper. I worked up to it in about a year. Some of the real hardcore can get up to a 500,000 or so, 20 times hotter than Tabasco. That's pretty freaking hot. At Scoville temperatures like that, your brain gets totally awash in endorphins. It's a better body stone than hash, and it's good for you. I was getting my sinuses back now, able to breathe without gasping. Of course, you get a ferocious ring of fire when you go to the John, she said, winking at me. Youch. You are insane, I said. Fine talk from a man whose hobby is building and smashing laptops, she said. Touché, I said, and touched my forehead. Want some? She held out her mister. Pass, I said, quickly enough that we both laughed. When we left the restaurant and headed for Dolores Park, she put her arm around my waist, and I found that she was just the right height for me to put my arm around her shoulders. That was new. I'd never been a tall guy, and the girls I dated had all been my height. Teenaged girls grow faster than guys, which is a cruel trick of nature. It was nice. It felt nice. We turned the corner on 20th Street and walked up toward Dolores. Before we'd taken a single step, we could feel the buzz. It was like the hum of a million bees. There were lots of people streaming toward the park, and when I looked toward it, I saw that it was about 100 times more crowded than it had been when I went to meet Ange. That sight made my blood run hot. It was a beautiful, cool night, and we were about to party, really party, party like there was no tomorrow. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Without saying anything, we both broke into a trot. There were lots of cops with tense faces, but what the hell were they going to do? There were a lot of people in the park. I'm not so good at counting crowds. The papers later quoted organizers as saying there were 20,000 people. The cops said 5,000. Maybe that means there were 12,500. Whatever. It was more people than I'd ever stood among as part of an unscheduled, unsanctioned, illegal event. We were among them in an instant. I can't swear to it, but I don't think there was anyone over 25 in that press of bodies. Everyone was smiling. Some young kids were there, 10 or 12, and that made me feel better. No one would do anything too stupid with kids that little in the crowd. No one wanted to see little kids get hurt. This was just going to be a glorious spring night of celebration. I figured the thing to do was push in toward the tennis courts. We threaded our way through the crowd, and to stay together, we took each other's hands. Only staying together didn't require us to intertwine fingers. That was strictly for pleasure. It was very pleasurable. The bands were all inside the tennis courts, with their guitars and mixers and keyboards and even a drum kit. Later, on XNet, I found a Flickr stream of them smuggling all this stuff in, piece by piece, in gym bags and under their coats. Along with it all were huge speakers, the kind you see in automotive supply places, and among them, a stack of car batteries. I laughed. Genius! That was how they were going to power their stacks. From where I stood, I could see that they were cells from a hybrid car, a Prius. Someone had gutted an eco-mobile to power the night's entertainment. The batteries continued outside the courts, stacked up against the fence, tethered to the main stack by wires threaded through the chain link. I counted 200 batteries. Christ, those things weighed a ton, too. There's no way they organized this without email and wikis and mailing lists, and there's no way people this smart would have done that on the public internet. This had all taken place on the XNet. I'd bet my boots on it. I danced until I was so tired I couldn't dance another step. Ange danced alongside me. Technically, we were rubbing our sweaty bodies against each other for several hours, but believe it or not, I totally wasn't being a horn dog about it. We were dancing, lost in the godbeat and the thrash and the screaming, "Take it back! Take it back!" When I couldn't dance anymore, I grabbed her hand and she squeezed mine like I was keeping her from falling off a building. She dragged me toward the edge of the crowd, where it got thinner and cooler. Out there, on the edge of Dolores Park, we were in the cool air and the sweat on our bodies went instantly icy. We shivered and she threw her arms around my waist. "Warm me," she commanded. I didn't need a hint. I hugged her back. Her heart was an echo of the fast beats from the stage. Breakbeats now, fast and furious and wordless. She smelled of sweat, a sharp tang that smelled great. I knew I smelled of sweat, too. My nose was pointed into the top of her head, and her face was right at my collarbone. She moved her hands to my neck and tugged. "Get down here. I didn't bring a stepladder," is what she said, and I tried to smile, but it's hard to smile when you're kissing. Like I said, I'd kissed three girls in my life. Two of them had never kissed anyone before. One had been dating since she was 12. She had issues. None of them kissed like Ange. She made her whole mouth soft, like the inside of a ripe piece of fruit. And she didn't jam her tongue in my mouth, but slid it in there and sucked my lips into her mouth at the same time. So it was like my mouth and hers were merging. I heard myself moan and I grabbed her and squeezed her harder. Slowly, gently, we lowered ourselves to the grass. We lay on our sides and clutched each other, kissing and kissing. The world disappeared, so there was only the kiss. My hands found her butt, her waist, the edge of her t-shirt, her warm tummy, her soft navel. They inched higher. She moaned too. "Not here," she said. "Let's move over there." She pointed across the street at the big white church that gives Mission Dolores Park and the mission its name. Holding hands, moving quickly, we crossed to the church. It had big pillars in front of it. She put my back up against one of them and pulled my face down to hers again. My hands went quickly and boldly back to her shirt. I slipped them up her front. "It undoes in the back," she whispered into my mouth. I had a boner that could cut glass. I moved my hands around to her back, which was strong and broad, and found the hook with my fingers, which were trembling. I fumbled for a while, thinking of all those jokes about how bad guys are at undoing bras. I was bad at it. Then the hook sprang free. She gasped into my mouth. I slipped my hands around, feeling the wetness of her armpits, which was sexy and not at all gross for some reason, and then brushed the sides of her breasts. That's when the sirens started. They were louder than anything I'd ever heard, a sound like a physical sensation, like something blowing you off your feet, a sound as loud as your ears could process, and then louder.
"Disperse immediately,"
a voice said, like God rattling in my skull.
"This is an illegal gathering. Disperse immediately."
The band had stopped playing. The noise of the crowd across the street changed. It got scared, angry. I heard a click as the PA system of car speakers and car batteries in the tennis courts powered up.
"Take it back!"
It was a defiant yell, like a sound shouted into the surf or screamed off a cliff.
"Take it back!"
The crowd growled, a sound that made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up.
"Take it back!"
they chanted.
"Take it back! Take it back! Take it back!"
The police moved in lines, carrying plastic shields, wearing Darth Vader helmets that covered their faces. Each one had a black truncheon and infrared goggles. They looked like soldiers out of some futuristic war movie. They took a step forward in unison, and every one of them banged his truncheon on his shield, a cracking noise like the earth splitting. Another step, another crack. They were all around the park and closing in now.
"Disperse immediately," the voice of God said again.
There were helicopters overhead now. No floodlights, though. The infrared goggles, right, of course. They'd have infrared scopes in the sky, too. I pulled Ange back against the doorway of the church, tucking us back from the cops and the choppers.
"Take it back!"
the PA roared. It was Trudy Dew's rebel yell, and I heard her guitar thrash out some chords, then her drummer playing, then that big, deep bass.
"Take it back!"
the crowd answered, and they boiled out of the park at the police lines. I've never been in a war, but now I think I know what it must be like. What it must be like when scared kids charge across a field at an opposing force, knowing what's coming, running anyway, screaming, hollering.
"Disperse immediately," the voice of God said.
It was coming from trucks parked all around the park, trucks that had swung into place in the last few seconds. That's when the mist fell. It came out of the choppers, and we just caught the edge of it. It made the top of my head feel like it was going to come off. It made my sinuses feel like they were being punctured with ice picks. It made my eyes swell and water, and my throat close. Pepper spray. Not 100,000 Scovilles. 1.5 million. They'd gassed the crowd. I didn't see what happened next, but I heard it, over the sound of both me and Ange choking and holding each other. First the choking, retching sounds. The guitar and drums and bass crashed to a halt. Then coughing. Then screaming. The screaming went on for a long time. When I could see again, the cops had their scopes up on their foreheads, and the choppers were flooding Dolores Park with so much light it looked like daylight. Everyone was looking at the park, which was good news, because when the lights went up like that, we were totally visible.
"What do we do?"
Ange said. Her voice was tight, scared. I didn't trust myself to speak for a moment. I swallowed a few times. "We walk away," I said. "That's all we can do, walk away, like we were just passing by. Down to Dolores and turn left and up towards 16th Street, like we were just passing by, like this is none of our business."
"That'll never work," she said.
"It's all I've got."
"You don't think we should try to run for it?"
"No," I said. "If we run, they'll chase us. Maybe if we walk, they'll figure we haven't done anything and let us alone. They have a lot of arrests to make. They'll be busy for a long time." The park was rolling with bodies, people and adults clawing at their faces and gasping. The cops dragged them by the armpits, then lashed their wrists with plastic cuffs and tossed them into the trucks like rag dolls. "Okay," I said.
"Okay,"
she said. And that's just what we did. Walked, holding hands, quickly and businesslike, like two people wanting to avoid whatever trouble someone else was making. The kind of walk you adopt when you want to pretend you can't see a panhandler or don't want to get involved in a street fight. It worked. We reached the corner and turned and kept going. Neither of us dared to speak for two blocks. Then I let out a gasp of air I hadn't known I'd been holding in. We came to 16th Street and turned down toward Mission Street. Normally, that's a pretty scary neighborhood at 2 a.m. on a Saturday night. That night, it was a relief. Same old druggies and hookers and dealers and drunks. No cops with truncheons. No gas. I said, as we breathed in the night air. "Coffee?"
"Home," she said.
"I think home for now. Coffee later."
"Yeah," I agreed. She lived up in Hayes Valley. I spotted a taxi rolling by and I hailed it. That was a small miracle. There are hardly any cabs when you need them in San Francisco. "Have you got cab fare home?"
Yeah, she said. The cab driver looked at us through his window. I opened the back door so he wouldn't take off. Good night, I said. She put her hands behind my head and pulled my face toward her. She kissed me hard on the mouth, nothing sexual in it, but somehow more intimate for that. Good night, she whispered in my ear, and slipped into the taxi. Head swimming, eyes running, a burning shame for having left all those ex-netters to the tender mercies of the DHS and the SFPD, I set off for home.
Well, there you go. I would have to say Comrade Doctorow is my second favorite Corey after the long-running British soap opera. For more info on Little Brother and numerous other stories, articles, novels, podcasts, etc. by Corey Doctorow, head straight for his website, craphound.com. There's no www in front of that, but if you type it by mistake, that's all right. You'll be redirected. I've only got room for a couple of musical tracks this week, so I'm going to play a couple of my favorite James Raymond songs. This is James on lead vocals in a song of his own composition with the group CPR. That's him, his dad, David Crosby, and Jeff Pivar. From their first self-titled album, CPR, this is Somebody Else's Town.
Stronger than fear. Love.
The last time I read to you from my novel Very Hard Choices in Spider on the Web number 39 on April 18th, we ran out of time in the midst of Chapter 5. Russell, a 60s survivor entering his 60s in British Columbia, and his 20-something son, Jesse, a PR man from New York, and Detective Constable Nika Mandich of the Vancouver Police, had all discovered they were being hunted by someone with very sophisticated surveillance gear because they know a telepath named Smelly. The obvious first thing to do is disappear in the rain. Here now are readings from chapters 5 and 6 of Very Hard Choices by Spider Robinson, and I stress that these are not excerpted from Blackstone Audiobook's official edition of that title, which won't be out for some time yet. This is just me in my office trying to interest you in buying the book on paper while it's still on the shelves. No one immediately apparent? Rain so thunderous there could be a platoon 100 meters away counting cadence without being immediately apparent. Behave naturally. Do not stare in all directions. Act like you're walking to the mailbox box to get the mail, which, come to think of it, you haven't done yet today. Natural to reach into pants pocket for mailbox key. Inspiration. Pretend you can't find it. Slow. Stop. Turn back toward house. Excuse to scrutinize everything to your left. Palm keys, remove them from pants pocket, pantomime finding them in jacket pocket, just in time to make it seem natural to convert a 180-degree turn into a 360, excuse to scrutinize everything to your right. Call me Chingachgook. No one immediately apparent. No official-looking vehicle visible. It is certainly possible to enter my property and find the house without using the driveway, but I did not believe any city man could or would do so in this rain without extensive preparation. If they were that good, we were screwed. I continued walking up the driveway until I reached the road. No vehicles visible in either direction, except Jesse's echo on the right. A driveway was visible in either direction, and for all I knew, squad cars or tanks could be parked 50 meters up either or both of them. The woods could be full of commandos. The rain made it easy to believe there were choppers somewhere nearby. The hell with it. I walked a few dozen steps back down the driveway and gave the two-fingered stevedore's whistle my bus driver father taught me, which can be heard in a hurricane or Manhattan rush hour. At once came the sounds of the front door being opened and closed firmly and footsteps on my creaky porch. So I turned and finished walking to the mailbox. No mail. I walked back the few steps to Jesse's car and waited there. Externally, it looked just like mine. Jesse and Nika appeared at the mouth of the driveway. I was standing beside the passenger side front door, but Nika walked past me and stood right beside me at the same door until I got it and moved to the back door. Okay. Inside, the echo was quite different from mine. Clean, for a start. No inch-thick layer of forest detritus on the floors. No CDs or MP3 discs in either of the compartments to either side of the car stereo. No ice scraper in the door boot. No smell of fine marijuana. Worse, it had been sprayed with fake new car scent recently. It started more easily for Jesse than mine did for me, too, and I knew why. He was starting it correctly by just turning the key. "Have you ever heard of starter fluid?" I asked my son out of curiosity. "For charcoal briquettes, I use propane. Someone please tell me where we're going." I cannot for the life of me seem to unlearn the habit of stamping on the accelerator once first to set the choke, which today is not only unnecessary but counterproductive. Nika turned in her seat so she could see both of us. "Russell, is there a place on the island we can use as a base for a day or two while we take turns mounting watch to see who shows up here to get his bug back?" I thought hard. Or tried to. "Yes, but what's your job situation?" "Shit." She bit her lip. "I have to get back and book off at 6. But I can be back again by, say, 8. "You'll never make the 7 o'clock ferry from downtown," I said with certainty. "You'll have to wait for the 8:30 and be back here at 9:15 at the earliest, just as the last ferry back to the mainland is leaving. You'll be staying the night." She nodded.
"Okay, but after that I have 4 free days."
Jesse said,
"It sounded like you just said you had 4 days off."
"I do. VPD officers all work 4 days off, 4 days on, and today is day 4 for me."
"Sweet."
She shrugged. "Uniform officers work 11-hour shifts, investigative sessions run longer. We need a longer weekend than most. And they shoot about 5% as many people each year as NYPD, I put in, even though the GVRD has about a third of New York's population. Jesse was scowling, but not from the implied insult to his beloved Big Apple. I hate this plan. Dad, what other ways are there to get to the mainland other than ferry? Could we rent a boat? Borrow one? Steal one? What's your thought? Where is Mr. X? I spread his hands. Maybe on his way here right now. Exactly. We don't know. What we're fairly sure of is that he is not around now, because he couldn't have heard us discussing coming up the driveway, but he wasn't here when we did. Even a man unfamiliar with the island should have found this place by now with GPS. If he hasn't come here yet, why would he? The rain cutting off his audio could have just made him decide to close in. It doesn't take any effort to argue with my son. I could do it in my sleep. Only if he was trying to follow the conversation, Nika said. And if he was, he'd have closed in earlier when that tape started to repeat. He'd be here by now. 2-1. Okay, fine, I said. Where are you going with this, Jesse? Well, if he's not here or on the way here, where is he? Oh. The penny dropped. He was right. Very close to the ferry. You think? Nika said. Wouldn't he stand out? He stands out less there than anywhere else, I told her. Jesse nodded. He draws minimal attention, and we can't get on the ferry without him seeing us. I can disguise, Nika began. Are you confident you can fool a professional? Jesse interrupted. A ferry line is a slow conveyor belt. He could have a camera and face recognition software on his laptop. In the rain? I think I could. Or one of you could drive me while I lay on the floor in the back. Yeah, and blink up at him standing there on the sidewalk as you go by at 5 per... Okay, the trunk then, all right? Unless you think he'll have radar on his laptop. It wasn't just me. Nika was picking up the knack of arguing with him, too. I don't know what he's got, Jesse insisted, except for a bug so expensive, assuming the worst is not a bad policy. What I do know is, when all the cows line up and start moving forward slowly, you don't want to be there. She rummaged for a comeback and finally sighed. I know what a choke point is. Okay, when you're right, you're right. Damn, agreeing with him. I'd never tried that. She turned to me. Well, what have you got? A splitting headache. I can get us a couple of boats. Why two? You and Jesse need to get to the mainland before 6. I need to get somewhere else fast. Why both of us? Jesse asked. Because you're not welcome where I'm going. I shouldn't go anywhere, Jesse said. I stay here and surveil this place. If someone does come, we have to be watching. It may be our only chance to learn anything. Don't be silly, son, I said. You're a stranger here. Which makes him the only one of us Mr. X can't know anything about, Nika said. Arguing with me came naturally to her. Jesse nodded eagerly. I haven't even used my credit card since I left New York, Dad. My car was pre-rented, and the company paid for it. Unless he checked every airline flight for the last few days to see if by any chance any of your relatives is in town, I'm invisible. Would any of your immediate neighbors put me up for a night without asking too many questions? In spite of myself, I saw where he was going. Well, Doug's barn is close to the driveway, and it's warm and dry inside. He won't mind. He's off shooting Harrison Ford. Beg pardon? Well, he's a cinematographer. Ford's in town this week. I'll see if he left an infrared camera behind. Don't take any chances, I said, at the same instant that Nika said, don't get near this guy! Our combined volume in a tiny car called Echo was enough to make all of us jump. I won't, Jesse assured us both, suppressing a natural impulse to smile in order to show us how serious he was. Where is this barn? Reluctantly, I pointed behind us. The driveway just before mine on the same side. Even better, he said. He has to go past me to reach your driveway. I'll definitely hear him. And you'll be approaching on the opposite side of Russell's house from him, Nika said. Time's short. Let's go. They both opened their doors and got out. Only Nika got back in on the driver's side this time. Jesse was already on his way in the rain. She buckled up. Wait, I began. Wish I could, she said, and put it in drive.
We turned around in old Milt's driveway, and I just had time to roll down my window and call, "Be careful, Jesse," before we were by him. I wished I'd had the hairs to add, "I love you." I turned to see him out the rear window, and he was gone. It was unsettling, but impressive. Chapter 6. I told myself he'd be fine. The barn would be unlocked because it was on Heron Island. Even if a neighbor happened to see him, he'd think nothing of it because this was Heron Island. It wasn't freezing. Jesse was smart enough to keep his head down. He seemed to know about high-tech surveillance stuff. Again, unsettling, but impressive. After a while, I turned around and faced forward again. A 5-minute drive will take you to anywhere on the island that isn't closer. The one I directed Nika on now took us to the home of the Young Salt, as I usually insisted on calling him. Keith Salt's father, Sam, had definitely been the Old Salt until his recent death, and Keith has managed to inherit both his love of the sea and his seamanship without also acquiring the old man's sour personality, his deeply pessimistic conservatism, or his allergy to pleasure. Keith and his wife, Lena, live in a beautiful house of their own right down on the water with a small dock for their boat, which they call the Asclepiadon, and everyone else on the island calls the Encyclopedia. She is a 27-foot Erickson sloop, if that conveys anything to you. To me, it sounds like a kind of fuzzy bug. As we parked in their turnaround and got out, I hoped they were both home. If so, there was no question they'd both agree to be Samaritans on a rainy night with a minimum of questions, whether they were happy about it or not, because it was Heron Island. If you want to live in a place where you can depend on others, live where they all have to depend on you, too. Then don't fuck up. Lena had the door open by the time we reached it, having heard us arrive. I waved Nika in ahead of me and followed on her heels. A huge amount of white noise went away when the door shut, as if a poorly tuned radio station had suddenly been dialed in properly. If you're old enough to remember when radio stations could be tuned poorly, back in ancient times when sky the color of TV tuned to a dead channel did not mean blue sky. "Hi, Russell," Lena said as we were dealing with wet things in the alcove. "Who's your friend?" "Lena, this is Nika," I said, "a.k.a. Constable Nika Detective Constable Nika Mandich, Vancouver Police. I forgot the terminology's been changed." "Hello, Mrs. Salt," Nika said. "Lena, out of the bag already at your age, huh?" Lena said. "Way to go, hon." Nika looked at her with more respect. "Thanks. I got lucky. Sorry to crash in on you without phoning like this, but our hand was forced." Lena had been about to usher us into the parlor. Now she stopped. "What do you need?" I already knew Keith wasn't home because he wasn't either here or bellowing greetings from the interior, but hopefully he was at least nearby. "Is himself around?" I asked hopefully. She shook her head. "Sorry, on the mainland for the night, helping a friend move." "Shit. Just what we need, too. Unfortunately, we need to move in 2 different directions at once, very soon." "Okay, we can, and neither of them can involve the ferry or anything in the marina." "I see," she lied politely. "Well, I can solve half your problem." "Know anybody who can solve the other?" She closed her eyes and thought for a full second before she said, "No," so I didn't ask if she was sure. She knew all the other boat people and all the seaplane types and the guy with the chopper pad. Shit. That was bad. Nika had to go first or draw unwelcome attention from her sergeant, who would surely ask why she was booking off late and would surely have an excellent bullshit detector. But that left me with nothing effective whatsoever to do for hours except wonder if my son was all right. Hell, until morning. Lena would get back no earlier than 10 o'clock and way too tired for me to ask her to go right back out with me. I wouldn't be, except you anyway, Lena finished. "Beg pardon? I don't, oh. Oh, dear God, I do understand." It was actually the ideal solution, really. I saw that at once, as quickly as my stomach began to protest. She was paying me an enormous compliment and doing me a serious favor at risk to herself, so I couldn't even be mad at her. There was nothing else to convert my fear into, nothing to do but suck it up. "How far do you have to go?" "To Coveney and back. Not far. You'll be okay if it doesn't get any uglier out than this, she said. You trust me that much in bad weather? Well, I figure you'll just fall overboard and drown. I can live with that. If you sink her, I'll never speak to you again. I wanted to find that touching, but was already getting seasick. Thank you too much. No, just enough. Chicken, you'll be fine. Anyway, the boat will. Just don't sink her. I smiled broadly. I looked at Nika, still smiling. What's wrong? She asked.
I'm calculating.
Let it go. She had to ask.
Calculating what?
Precisely how much I'd care if you got killed by some CIA spook.
Don't ask.
Her eyes flicked to Lita and she let it go. Quick on the uptake. Yeah, damn it, I care. The encyclopedia was equipped with a little hyphen outboard powered inflatable job. That's hyphenated correctly. It was powered by a little outboard. That Keith called the fiendish dinghy, and Lena called the killer Zodiac. It was a great little conveyance, if you didn't mind bailing a lot and getting wet anyway, and assuming you never had engine trouble someplace where you'd need to paddle it more than a few meters downstream with the wind. It would suck if Nika bought it. I'm not a big fan of boats. I'm not even a tiny fan of tiny boats. If the tiny boat is basically a truck tire inner tube with a floor, a rippling inch-thick floor, and a propeller sticking out the back, I become a microfan at best. Okay, it would suck a lot. I'm going to be the only one in the truck tire? Toward sunset in the rain? Heading for a destination that's likely to kill me on arrival? Now I'm in the nanofan range. I looked at her, looking back at me. Detective Constable Nika Mandich, not only not a friend, but my spiritual and psychological and emotional antipod, had once, almost the last time I'd seen her, I was ashamed to admit to myself, knowingly risked rape, torture, maiming, dismemberment, personality disintegration, soul extinction, and after what would surely have been far too long for it to be any mercy, death, for no better reason than to save me from the same fate. Well, and a family of four, also strangers. And dozens, if not hundreds, after that. But that night she could have just turned around and left, gone home and made a plan, come back with reinforcements, confident that I'd be alive next morning, if not necessarily still salvageable. Nobody else on the planet suspected I had a problem, or that she knew a thing about it, or even that we'd ever met. Save one person who couldn't talk to anyone but me. Total available backup on the island was two RCMP officers, and the sober one was a fuck-up legendary throughout the whole lower mainland. She had gone through the door, alone, up against that creature, with nothing but a handgun, not one of its slugs cast from silver. For her trouble, she'd ended up sprawled across my couch with her own handcuffs on her wrists and his on her ankles, bleeding from one ear and waiting for a brilliant, very bad death to begin. Face it, Russell, if she got taken out by some government golem just because she was lucky enough to meet you once, it would suck one holy jumping fuck of a lot. Not as bad as losing Jess, not as bad as losing Susan was, but in that band of the spectrum. Well, Lena prompted. She'd waited more than a polite interval. Still meeting Nika's eyes, I felt my smile become smaller, but now it was genuine. She saw it at once. I already knew the answer. It's just better if I check my math. Let's roll. If you've sailed or even read a magazine with pictures of boats in it, you can probably skip the next part. The rest of you, this is the part Travis McGee glosses over when he makes the busted flush sound like fun. Damn, it's tough to pull out when the lines are all wet and tied in knots you've never seen before and the engine's not that happy to start and the wind is insistently advising you to remain right here up against this slip where you're safe and even the wheel is saturated and it's not looking to get better anytime soon. Sure, you're wearing borrowed slick yellow overalls, jacket, and comedy hat that probably don't really weigh 20 kilos, and most of the water is rolling off. But while man can make a suit that will keep out Ebola virus, keep him breathing in vacuum, or cool in a furnace, it is apparently fundamentally impossible to fashion a garment that will keep out more than 98% of a British Columbia rain, which leaves about a pint a minute unaccounted for. God knows why, it seems to seek the neck area, and for some reason sailors have not yet evolved as far as divers in intelligence. Their rubber suit is way too loose for a wetsuit effect to provide any warmth. If you've got any sense, you've changed out of the runners that have been your only footgear for over a decade now into nine-league boots. But you hate clumping around a small sailboat in boots, and you see yourself putting a booted foot through the floor, deck, of the rubber truck tire, and if you had any sense, you wouldn't be here, so each shoe holds another pint. Socks and Stanfields make great wicks. Moisture is approaching your crotch from both above and below before you've even sat on anything. Lena coaxes the engine into surly life, and then it all starts to happen fast. You and Nika each spring to untie one of the spring lines, a little sailing humor there. Then Nika springs to untie your spring line, too, while Lena curses in Greek. You don't waste seconds being mortified. There'll be plenty of time later. But spring to untie the stern line. There's just time to break a fingernail and see a half-full film container of Kootenai Thunderfuck fall from your shirt pocket into the drink before Nika frees the bow line and comes to untie yours, apparently with a gesture, while Lena curses in classical Greek. Nika mimes, "Push it away from the slip and jump aboard real fast." You mime, "Are you fucking kidding me?" Nika glares, "Idiots, not our boat. Hurry!" You nod, turn to push, and discover as you leave vertical that by now the boat has done fine on its own. Instantly you compute distance, as far as you can jump with a running start, form the theory that sufficient desperation is just as helpful, and decide to test it, since you're leaving the dock one way or another anyway. Total effort. Belated realization that half of effort merely pushed Doc away from you. Joyous realization in midair that you will, nonetheless, reach the boat just like in the... Then things happen very fast as you land on the rail and your groin and fold and your face hits both of your fists just as they hit the deck, just as both knees hit the hull, just as Lena guns it in reverse and you roll left, which makes your body half close and fly wide open again like a dropped laptop. So now the back of your face and groin both hurt too, but there's enough rebound so that it's easy to get your elbows under you and try to sit and start sliding off the rail feet first toward an astonishing quantity of water, and hook both forearms under the rail and find out what a great idea that was, and your eyes open wide and refocus on Nika standing at the edge of the dock already a mile away, just in time to see her crouch all of 10 centimeters and step across the water and pass over your head. And then things slow rapidly so that by the time she's hauled you back aboard, you're reassuring yourself the extensive inventory of places you hurt does not seem to include either of your collapsible lungs. Lena bellows, "Leave the rubbers on!" or something like it from up at the wheel of the boat. Pause. "I'm not wearing them!" you yell back with your test chest full of air. Pause. "Don't take the fucking rubber off yet!" I look down at my groin. I hate admitting that, but I may as well. Nika caught me at it and must have told people by now. She made a noise like swallowing something horrid she'd snorted, touched my relocating shoulder, and pointed just as that sneaky doc came racing at us without warning and whacked a square in the rubber bumpers hanging over the side. She was pointing with one hand and keeping me from tumbling headfirst back onto the dock with the other, so I assume she held onto the boat with her butt cheeks. We waited until Lena had put her in drive and pulled away, and then a minute more, before hauling the rubbers in and stowing them. There was not being laughed at by Nika, and then there was being laughed at by Lena, and if you ask me which was harder to take, I'm going to need more time. I was distracted by how hard to take wet clothes are. In the movies, boats are nearly always adequately equipped with spare dry clothing for all in some unseen storage space. Unless the wet person is a woman with attractive breasts. And sure enough, Lena, a woman with attractive breasts, had no clothes aboard at all. Except for an orange life vest I was glad to put on, even though it made me look like a gay Imperial stormtrooper, and a pair of boat shoes that looked even flimsier than mine, but had better traction.
Good weather, Lena said.
We stared.
It is, she insisted.
Nothing hard about sailing in the rain. Rain accompanied by high wind and waves is bad. Your timing's good till you'll be heading into what wind and current there is on your way to Coveney.
Super.
Would you rather they were against you on your way back when you're tired? We booted it straight out from the salt stock for half a click or so, then Lena turned right, or in nautical terms, hung a right, and we began circling Heron Island. Left would have been a shorter route both for me and for Nika as the crow swims, but right, while longer, was better for me. Lena explained the wind, tide, and current reasons why this was so, even drawing little calligraphic objects she believed illuminated things. I bought it, but didn't get it or bother to retain it. In only a few minutes, we were rounding the point by the west-facing beach, imaginatively named Sunset Beach. I went back topside. The wind picked up a little, and the rain eased off a little, and Coveney Island came into view in the declining light of late afternoon. It looked like something it would take an Apollo program to reach.
Not that far,
Nika said behind me. She actually sounded confident I'd have no problem.
Maybe it wouldn't spark that much.
No. Strong hand on my right shoulder. Good luck, Russell. Squeeze. I'm really sorry. I tried to shrug without shrugging off the hand, and succeeded.
You and I were going to have to do something about Zooty sooner or later anyway.
And each other.
Should have a long time ago.
The rain let up some more. All we needed was the faintest clue what to do. She snorted.
See? We didn't actually need that after all.
Speak for yourself. She cleared her throat. Look, I'm probably going to have to send Lena home without me and find my own transport when I can. Booking off is going to be more complicated than usual tonight, and I don't know how long it'll take.
Oh, the new chief?
2 days before, the mayor had appointed a new chief of police, Jim Chu, the first Chinese-Canadian ever to hold that job, in a city whose ethnic Chinese population approaches 20%. The transition period was bound to be a complicated time for cops.
Exactly. I don't know how fast I'll be able to get back out here tonight, but I promise you it'll be as fast as I can make it.
Her hand squeezed my shoulder again.
I'll watch out for him.
I was touched and relieved and slightly jealous.
Thank you, Nika. You remember my cell number?
Christ, no. I patted my hip pocket. But mine has it in Jesse's in memory. The rain slacked way off to the condition I've always called smutch, a random floating dampness like being underneath one of God's sneezes. I looked up, began to offer thanks, decided not to risk calling attention to myself, realized I was worried about a God I had not believed in for half a century, and wondered if I should be allowed out without a keeper. The engine slowed, then died. Lena went below, as we sailors call downstairs, and came up out of the whole thing carrying a big duffel bag.
Time to make sail. Russ, you're underfoot. Why don't you jump overboard?
Of course. Together we all got the inflatable over the side of the encyclopedia without either sinking or losing it. I wonder why boats stop being her when they get real small.
The fiendish dinghy, I said admiringly.
The killer Zodiac, Lena said automatically.
I devoutly hope not.
Don't be silly. I told you all you really need to know.
Tell me again.
Don't let the waves hit you from the side. Keep them dead ahead or dead astern. That's basically it. As long as you don't run out of gas, you'll be fine. And you won't. I checked.
What if a big gas leak just started now?
Row, she pointed. I hoped for oars and saw paddles.
How's it handle? Nika asked.
Lena shrugged.
Like a kid's swimming pool.
Nika turned to me.
Have you done much rowing?
Politely phrased. I don't tell a lot of people about the annoying tendency of my lungs to collapse. How was she to know Lena was one of the ones I had told? I said what I always used to say when my late wife Susan asked me if a given task was within my acceptable range.
Oh, sure, no sweat.
I wasn't going to have to row anyway. Lena said so. Unlike Susan, Nika bought it.
Good luck, then,
Lena echoed her. I thanked them both. With their help, I managed to get into the dinghy without soaking myself much further, learning in the process why Keith called it fiendish. I assumed it was a Beatles reference.
"Where's the handle?"
I yelled back up to Lena, looking the motor over for a pull cord to yank. Pause.
"Just under your ribs on either side,"
she yelled back, pointing to the ignition key. Pause.
"I knew that."
I turned the key and it started up much faster and smoother than the encyclopedia's main engine had. I heard Lena yell what must have been,
"We never doubted you,"
then figured out the throttle and went away from there. Somehow it took only seconds to be all alone. And no time at all to be lonesome. Now to play us out, here's a James Raymond track from the 2004 double CD Crosby Nash. This one is called Luck Dragon.
Loud voices calling and the smell of steel. The kings amongst the commoners, but someone has to steer. Streamers and cannon fire, distant to the ear. Drivers leave their wheels, the workmen leave their tools, and the white ball hangs, and the red ball falls. The luck dragon flies tonight. The last stop on some journey to reach a far off sea. Who will fall in battle? Who will be the first to flee? And voices here right next to me, yet somehow distant too. Echoes bouncing off the wall with the meaning. Drivers leave their wheels, the workmen leave their tools, and the white ball hangs, and the red ball falls. The luck dragon flies tonight. Do you know anyone? Anyone at all? Anyone at all?
full lick. Please come back next week for Spider on the Web number 44. We appreciate your subscriptions, your donations, your good thoughts generally, and particularly we appreciate you running out to your local bookstore and buying those books, such as Very Hard Choices, Variable Star by Robert A. Heinlein and Spider Robinson, and The Stardance Trilogy by Spider and Gene Robinson. Your comments and suggestions are welcomed at www.spiderrobinson.com. Now let's go try and make somebody smile.